When the Karate Kid ended with a crane kick in 1984, it seemed like it was all over.
But then came sequels, and then came a remake. And now, courtesy of YouTube Red, we have Cobra Kai, a surprisingly good series that catches up with the film's hero, Daniel LaRusso, and villain, Johnny Lawrence, many years later.
Neither one has gotten over high school. They still don't like each other. Only now, there are a couple of middle-aged men who just want to feel, you know, that winning feeling.
I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Cobra Kai on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, so don't go away.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Microsoft Surface Laptop. At just under 3 pounds and with up to 14 and a half hours of battery life, Surface Laptop lets you binge watch your favorite shows whenever and wherever you want. Do more with Surface Laptop. Thin, light, and beautiful.
Welcome back. With us this week to talk about Cobra Kai is All Things Considered host Audie Cornish. Hi, Audie.
Hey.
And coming to us from the great state of Florida, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hey, I'm loving the classic rock. That is jamming.
Right? And that is true. I will say, one of the things about the show is that they do go back to a lot of the soundtrack of The Karate Kid, which is amazing.
But they also, because it is a low-budget show, they'll refer to Guns N' Roses and then play Rat.
Yeah. It's true, but they also do talk about Rat.
Like there's a difference?
Yeah. All right. So my reaction to this, and I said this when I wrote about it, was surprisingly not terrible. What did you think, Stephen?
I found it instantly bingeable. I found myself maybe 5-10 minutes into this show before I thought, you know, even if I weren't covering this for Pop Culture Happy Hour, I'm going to watch this whole thing.
Yeah.
And it's weird. I think it speaks to the kind of enduring power of the original from 1984, which imprinted very, very deeply on my psyche and kind of the way I view bullies in general. Mm-hmm. I can watch bullies get kicked in the face absolutely, infinitely. Mm-hmm. Like, I could just watch an infinite loop of Johnny Lawrence getting crane kicked in the face. Uh-huh. Forever. And this show kind of gives you the opportunity to watch Johnny Lawrence get re-crane kicked in the face a bunch of times. But it weirdly goes deeper than that. You see these two guys, Johnny Lawrence and Daniel LaRusso, bad guy, good guy, you know, 30 some odd years later, still reliving high school. And neither one of them is necessarily the hero of the show.
Yeah.
And I think that's the smartest thing that this show does is establish that neither one of these guys is consistently in the right.
Well, right. And neither one of them has gotten past that encounter and that idea of that high school battle.
Yeah, just to give a little bit of a background on where these characters are as of this show, Johnny has spent decades as a basically washout. And over the course of the season, he is starting up a new version of Cobra Kai and training new recruits from an area high school. As for Daniel, he is a very successful car salesman, and his ad campaigns are all built around around karate.
Yeah.
And so it's like, we'll kick the competition.
Yeah.
And you buy a car, you get a bonsai tree. And he doesn't actually...
It's real corny.
Yeah, he doesn't realize...
You mean he didn't embrace the culture? The way you thought he would? Is that what you thought the takeaway from Karate Kid was in the original?
The cultural embrace.
Exactly.
It.
And I do want to come back to the balance between these two guys, but I want, Audie, why don't you weigh in? What did you think about the series? You interviewed the writers, right?
I did. And their attitude was, if Kimmy Gibbler can get a billboard, Johnny Lawrence should get a billboard, sort of referring to the return of Fuller House.
Yes.
And part of the greater conversation about nostalgia TV and lots of brands being revived for one reason or another. And this was not the brand I thought needed reviving. You know, I did not lay in bed at night thinking,
you were not
but
clamoring.
You know what I really need to come back to.
Yeah.
But I thought they did it in a clever way for two reasons. One, because they did pull away from the 80s good, evil dichotomy, right? Which was great for that period and those teen movies, but I think we're all used to watching things that are just much more complex now. Mm-hmm. And two, because they did this very sweet sort of Rashomon approach to the storytelling, where you see the entire plot of Karate Kid told in flashbacks, but from the point of view of the bully, it was sort of funny, you know, and fun. And even if you hadn't seen the original movie, you could tell that it was playing with the idea of like narrative and people's truth and like what is the truth. And so, yeah, I'd love to hear what other people thought. But those were my two big at the start kind of initial thoughts.
Yeah. What'd you think, Eric?
Billy Zabka. Man, was a revelation to me in this. The guy who plays Johnny Lawrence.
Did you think you would be speaking that sentence?
I certainly did not. I mean, that was the coolest thing about watching this, was watching him return to the role, give it a humanity, play this guy who's been a loser since he got kicked in the face, and still you care about that character and you care about what happens to him. And you're rooting for him in a weird way, even though he's racist, even though he's sexist, and even though he's still something of a bully. And that's a triumph to me. And this whole series, this 10 episodes, felt like a prologue. You know, it felt like we are seeing these two guys kind of unbalanced. And what's going to balance them? And will they ever find their balance? I mean, you know, Danny always seemed on the verge of kind of being a jerk. And Mr. Miyagi's teachings was the thing that kind of pulled him back and turned him into a hero. And in these 10 episodes, we see him kind of lose his way and become kind of sleazy and kind of jerky. And we wonder what's going to pull him back.
Yeah. And they acknowledge that, like in later parts of the season, they acknowledge him kind of going to, I mean, Pat Morita has long since passed, but they acknowledge him going to Mr. Miyagi's grave and saying, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. Mm-hmm. And kind of acknowledge, like they've paid attention enough to the movies and the characters to know that Danny LaRusso was a brat. He was a loser and a brat who got to one-up the bully and get the girl, but that doesn't mean he was like a good kid. And when you lose your mentor and you lose your way, what happens to you?
Right. The easiest way to do this show would have been, you know, Johnny is now coaching one kid, Daniel is now coaching another kid, and it's really about the kids with kind of the guys as nostalgia hooks.
Yes.
But what they decide to do instead is really follow these two middle-aged guys, which particularly for YouTube Red is a different, it's so young in its targeting. But I think they made a decision in this case to stick with these middle-aged guys. And one of the things that I really found resonant about it is, like, so often villains in shows don't really resonate with me. They're drug lords or they're, you know, they're the kind of people that you don't run into day to day. But Johnny as a kind of middle-aged, angry, entitled, racist, sexist dude who peaked in high school and is still angry at all the things he feels like were unfair to him, that feels very present to me. That feels very much like a person that you do run into when you're out driving on the street and all of a sudden somebody is flipping you the bird and yelling at you. It's that kind of guy that you run into day to day. The immediacy of that menace to me was more affecting than a lot of bad guys on television.
And we should say the show is not political. I think when I heard your description, I thought, oh no, what is this? One of these like post-Trump kind of depictions of a person. It doesn't do anything like that.
No, it's not.
But it's the idea of this character coming up against modern etiquette and modern social mores. So like the kid he approaches who he takes on to teach karate at one point makes a crack about letting a girl into their dojo, you know, and he's like, says a comment about her and the kid says, well, I think you're gendering her.
Right.
And there's a laugh that to me was respectful of both generations.
Yeah.
And I think that's a question for all of these kind of nostalgia products is like, how are you addressing how these characters occupy today? And are you doing it in a relevant way?
It does resonate for me with some of the political moment of the last year or two, but I think that's how it resonated with me. I don't think it's necessarily the intent of the show. Because you're right, the show does not really get into political stuff at all.
Yeah, I think also, too, it seems to me like they're trying to keep the Billy Zabka character, Johnny, relatable.
Oh, and, sure.
And to layer all that political stuff on it might, you know, be a barrier to entry. But what I loved about this series is that it does try to explain why he's that way. We get to see his jerky stepdad, played by Ed Asner in a wonderful cameo. And we do get to hear about how he was raised by these two bullies. I guess we shouldn't spoil the very end of it, but we're going to find out more about his relationship with his mentor, too. We may even find that those guys thought they were doing the right thing in the worst way, which also helps contemporize the story, I think.
There's a lot of lessons on this show about teaching and on the power of teaching and how you can learn and be taught the exact right or the exact wrong lessons by somebody who has an enormous amount of power over you. And you see that passed down from generation to generation, where heroes become villains and villains become heroes, based in part on the teaching. And I think that's really interesting. I also wanted to say about this show, to put it in the larger context of the TV landscape, separate from the political landscape. I was talking to our producer, Jessica Reedy, last week about this show, and she made a really smart comparison where she compared it to Twin Peaks and the return of Twin Peaks, and how you have this show that is, by definition, extreme fan service, right? Like, The Karate Kid is a movie from 1984. As you said, Audie, no one was clamoring for, right, you know, for it to be followed up 34 years later. They've taken this show, this very old property, and yes, there have been a lot of sequels and stuff, but they've taken this very old property, and they've made the decades a character in the show, kind of the way the decades are a character in Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting. And I think both of those shows, the parts of both of those shows that I found the most profound are about that passage of time.
Yeah. And it's funny to find yourself saying, like, so this is where Twin Peaks is different from Fuller House. But that's exactly what it is that rather than just saying, like, let's just age everybody up and try to make basically the same show with everybody aged up, this has a really different tone than the films did, certainly. And it's much more interested in the complexities of these two guys. In particular, you know, we've talked a lot about Billy Zabka, and I think that's right. But I also think they've changed, as Audie was talking about. You know, Daniel is, you're sort of brought into that, like, was it ever as simple as him being particularly good? And sometimes...
And people loved Ralph Macchio. You have to remember, like, he was, like, Tiger Beat-ish. He was the man. And in part, it was the goodness, the halo from Karate Kid.
And when you see some of those moments from the film retold from Johnny's perspective, you think, yeah, he did sort of participate in ratcheting the whole thing up and kind of going to war with Johnny and his friends. It is interesting. I really was disappointed, though, that they never do get back to that kid who I consider the most menacing person in the history of film. Is the kid at the end of Karate Kid who's standing next to the coach who yells, "Get him a body bag! Yeah!" And he's the most menacing, creepy. That guy is now in jail, I bet. Because that guy is just a bad dude.
But they did create another character, and I think this gets to the new generation aspect of it. Because in Cobra Kai, essentially, the kids who populate Johnny Lawrence's dojo are actually all the nerds. Mm-hmm. And you watch them over the course of the season become bullies in of themselves. Mm-hmm. And one of the characters in particular becomes the kind of person who would yell, "Give him a body bag." And that's not how he started, the 10th grade or whatever.
Well, that's what I think what Stephen was getting at about teaching. You have to be so careful how you're directing the energy of kids.
Well, those kids, the kind of outcasts and losers, and Johnny sees them as losers, that you see this mix of them being taught bad lessons and good lessons.
Yeah, stand up for yourself by kicking someone in the face.
by striking first.
Yeah, exactly.
You should always strike first.
Well, and you keep having that instinct where you want to go, like, yeah, Johnny's getting it. Johnny's kind of figuring out how to nurture nerds. And then he'll just be like, he'll say some horrible thing where you'll be like, but no, not that. No, don't do that.
I want to get back to your point quickly about the Get Him a Body Bag Kid. Because The Karate Kid and The Christmas Story are the two movies I can think of that best understand that the absolute worst character isn't the bully, it's the toady.
Yeah. That is so true. That is very, very true. I do think we should check in on the fact that this is on YouTube Red. And I think YouTube Red, like every cable network, and Eric can kind of check my thinking about this, but, you know, my sense is that every cable network, streaming outlet, whatever, has not necessarily one, but a couple of moments when it tries to establish what it is. And to me, this is one of the things that YouTube Red is doing to try to establish itself as a place that makes original content that old people might know about. Mm-hmm. Because I think the ascendancy of YouTube is massive among people who are younger than the people in this room.
Yeah.
But I think for people like me, there haven't been that many YouTube originals that have come specifically from YouTube that have made a huge mark on me. How do you feel about this, Eric?
Yeah, well, what's interesting, so I spent a day on the set actually hanging out with some of these guys, hanging out with Ralph Macchio and the three executive producers who created the show. And one of the things they said was when they shopped this idea around, YouTube sat down with them and sort of gave them, kind of pitched them and gave them all this data on how much people were watching old Karate Kid clips on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And so some of the reason why YouTube Red picked up this series and fought to get it was that they had a sense that their audience was already interested in mm-hmm. it. And so that's part of the new reality is that Hulu and Netflix and Amazon and now YouTube, they have a lot of data on what yeah. their people are already watching.
Yeah.
And they can try to put something in front of them that sort of caters to that.
Yeah.
But it's also what you said, which is, you know, these new outlets are taking big swings trying to put something out there that will define their audience for them and define how to create TV product that reaches that audience. So Hulu tries a bunch of stuff, and Handmaid's Tale is what clicks.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly they realize, hey, this is the kind of programming that Hulu's audience will really respond to and that the industry will also respond to.
Yeah.
And so YouTube Red is kind of in that moment where they've taken their first big swing with something that has a name that the people outside of the YouTube community know about. And I think this is just the beginning for them.
Just to jump right. in really briefly, the implications of what Eric said, I think, are really enormous. The idea of this, like, data-driven content
yeah.
creation
yeah.
for a couple of reasons, good and bad. But to sum it up, I think that for a while I thought, like, oy, I'd open up Amazon Prime or Hulu or whatever, and I would see 10 pilots. And I would just think, ugh, I don't know if I have time to figure out if any of these are any mm-hmm. good or what's going on. And I don't know if that system is much better than the traditional network piloting creation by committee that happens, where we largely don't see that
right.
much of the process, and then pilots kind of appear and come and go. I do think, though, what it does is it drives a lot more of this stuff that's really just based on brand recognition. And I do want to see new and original content,
mm-hmm.
and I do want people to come up with new things, and I don't want my doofus 10 p.m. at night clicks on old things to, like, be a content driver, if that makes any sense.
They
you know
will
what
be,
I'm
though.
Saying?
They will
but
be,
But I
though.
Can understand why, because if it's true that there were 400-plus TV shows made in 2017, it's much easier to make something that people know the name of yeah. than it is to create something new.
Well, and the other thing is what Eric's talking about in terms of data use for streaming services and increasingly for everybody is not only for nostalgia shows, though. It's also for when Ryan Murphy went to Netflix. There was a lot of talk about how when Netflix was sort of courting him, one of the things that they have the ability to do when he's going to come make new stuff for them, and the same thing is true with Shonda Rhimes when she went to make new stuff for them, is that they can sit down and say, our audience likes your existing shows, so you can make new shows for us. So it's not just for nostalgia purposes. It's also just for audience targeting purposes, where you say, if you come here, you have a built-in audience here that will watch what you make. But it cuts both ways, because it's not just the use of data, it's also the control of data. Because on the one hand, Netflix and Hulu and places like that have a lot of data about what people are watching, but that doesn't mean they're always going to share it with you. And they share it with you even as a creator, as I understand it. They share it very
selectively.
Interesting. And there have been situations where people have said, you know, it's hard to get paid for how popular, for example, Orange is the New Black was, when even the people making it didn't really know how many people were watching it. So it's harder to negotiate because you don't know how much power you have, because they won't tell you how much money it's making. And that typically gets spun as, we don't want our creators to worry about numbers and ratings and stuff like that. But the creators...
We're getting paid.
You know,
you know,
exactly.
Like
the creators are then sometimes in the dark. So that use of data by Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and YouTube and all those guys, I think, like Eric said, is a developing story.
Can I bring up one more thing?
Absolutely.
Karate Kid and Asian culture and diversity, I've always been a little bit troubled by this franchise in that
mm-hmm.
way. It's always felt like a story that would be whitewashed if they didn't have the one Japanese character to kind of redeem
there
it.
There wasn't for that pesky and karate.
Yeah.
And so now they've, you know, brought the show into modern times. That one Asian character is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they talk about his memory, it's even more whitewashing, this appropriation of Asian culture and ideas and philosophies without any Asian people in a major role. And that's one of the things that kind of bugged me the most about this remake is I'm sort of thinking, wow, they took a situation that really kind of bugged me a little bit about The Karate Kid and made it even worse.
Yeah. And they could have fixed it, right? Like decades passed.
Right.
You know, it's
there
in
were
California.
There were options for sure.
Well, I don't think they wanted to look like they were replacing Pat Morita.
Right.
And in interviewing those guys, they all were huge fans of the original movie, the three executive producers. And that's one thing they sort of stressed with me is they didn't want to try and replace him. But but that's a big problem, I think, with this series is that, you know, there are no major characters played by an Asian person, even though there's all this talk of karate and the values behind it.
Yeah, I think that's a great
point.
Right,
and to add to that, having such a person cast, like, any kind of tokenism necessarily, like, wouldn't necessarily have made it better. But I take your point about the idea that, like, it's a very surface glancing towards any Japanese culture. I mean, literally, it's like it's as surface as the fact that Danny LaRusso now gives away bonsai trees at his car dealership. That's as deep as the show itself goes into the cultural ideas.
I was just going to say, I think the closest the show comes to sort of dealing with this in any way is recognizing the kind of cheesy quality to Daniel's use of karate in business. I think Eric's exactly right. It's not an exception to what Eric is saying, but it's like the show kind of knows that Daniel's use of the bonsai trees and the karate in the course of his business is sort of a perversion of what he was taught. Mm-hmm. But sort of together with what Eric's talking about, it makes it really hard for them to go very deeply into that. I think that's true. All right. Well, let us know what you think about Cobra Kai. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow Audie at NPR Audie and Eric at Deggins. Before we go, Audie, you have something that you want to tell the people about.
I do. I do. I'm finally getting a chance to talk to people for longer than 4 minutes at a time. It's going to be in a live event series launching this year. Our first one is this month. It's Tuesday, June 26th. It's with the singer Gregory Porter, who's a fantastic jazz artist. And people can get tickets at nprpresents.org.
And that's happening here at NPR HQ.
NPR HQ. I will finally get to see you all face to face.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you, Audie, for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you, Eric, for being here.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening. We'll be back here on Friday to dive deeply and profoundly into the franchise that is Law & Order. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts. That will help more folks to find the show. We will see you all back here on Friday.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.